of knowing. But it does so in a manner that leaves no weakness or insecurity, and also by discipline relieves the human being of one intensely dangerous reflex, and that is fantasy. Until fantasy is conquered, every spiritual discipline of man is a danger to him. Inasmuch as fantasy can and usually is mistaken for an advanced state of knowing. Fantasy exists as long as the various departments of man's personality are undeveloped. As long as the human being is selfish, he can fall into fantasy, and does. As long as he is egocentric, he is suffering not only from hallucination, but the danger of many errors and many phantoms arising in his experience. While he is capable of anger, he is capable of error. The moment the individual finds that he has reached the extremity of his own temperance, he has reached the circumference of his own safety. That is terribly, terribly important. Man living from within himself and planning and preparing for a superior kind of existence reminds me a little bit of the writings of the French transcendentalist, Elvis Levy. And this priest, who took the Kabbalistic name of Levy, said that the astral light, which is so important in certain mystical things, is a beautiful garden of wonderful flowers, each one with a poisonous serpent twisted around the stem. This is the fool paradise, and the only paradise the fool can ever inhabit. It is the paradise of wishing. It is the paradise of mystery and imagining. It is the paradise of fantasy. It is where the individual finds it possible to validate anything he hopes for, wishes for, or believes in. But every wish, every hope, turns upon him, and he discovers that his beauty conceals a poison. So, the development of consciousness requires and demands discipline. And the purpose of Dharma Yoga is to achieve this integrity and security in relation to knowing. It is the individual coming finally to the experience that his own belief that he knows is the great illusion which he faces. And that as long as that illusion remains, he is insecure. And that as long as he believes that with his own egocentric, polarized entity, he is capable of the ultimate attainment of knowledge, he is also going to fall under the fantasy that he today and at this hour knows more than he does. That everything that we do is moved largely from opinion, and that opinion is the falsest form of foundation. That before then he can go on to the disciplines which may lead to the higher phases of his subject, he must free himself from the illusion of false knowledge, and the illusion that knowledge can be possessed by him. This is a long road, and what we call learning is the gradual discovery that we do not know. Now, in line with the thought that we had last week, we friends have suggested that about this time in the talk, we give everybody a 5-minute stretch. How many folks would like, think that's a good idea? All right, let's have a 5-minute stretch and then go on. This made a good point to bring because it gives us a turning point between this and certain positive expressions which we want to consider. Now, we've already mentioned this problem of the divided self. The self in each person, struggling desperately to know what is in everyone else, and ending by not even knowing what's in himself. Well, it occurs to those who are a little bit thoughtful, perhaps, that assuming that we should find out all there is to know about ourselves, we would still be in a poverty-stricken state unless this also gave us a dimension of extending consciousness to something outside of ourselves. It really makes very little difference what we do with the prison as long as we stay in it and the door is still locked. We may allow it to remain a hovel or we may make a palace out of it, but we are still captives, we are still held within the most dangerous pattern in the world, and that is our isolation. The only possible solution, then, to the significance of consciousness, even for the average person, is that through it he can experience something beyond himself. Now, to experience something beyond himself, he has to assume that his consciousness extends beyond himself. And he attempts to approach this problem on the level of parapsychology, or on such experiments as telepathy and things of that nature, by means of which it seems possible that he may experience something beyond himself. But study your records in your parapsychology work, and you will find that it is perfectly possible by telepathy to exchange the spots on a dice or the figures on a deck of cards. But there have been no reports by parapsychology of an individual actually experiencing the consciousness of anything else. So that hasn't proved the answer. And it probably will remain a blind alley. Because we are still dealing only with a magnetic field and the possibility of mental transference of image, which is not unknown and has been practiced for thousands of years. But there again, this does not unlock the door to man's unification as a conscious experience of being. Now, if we wish to assume for the moment a platonic position, and to begin with the concept of totality, and to recognize that totality represents one knowing power, and infinitely diversified but undivided, we may begin to get nearer to something. There is the old description that comes in both Eastern and Western literature of the man who put his fingers through the holes in the curtain. And the man on the outside said, "I see 5 fingers. But the man behind said, "I see 1 hand. And that is one of the problems. We see on the outside, on the phenomenal side, separate parts that we are beginning to apperceive as a rational necessity. That these parts are the members of one thing larger than the totality of themselves and including all these parts. In your Eastern concept of yoga, therefore, selves, conscious entities, are recognizable as parts of a totality greater than themselves. And here is another important thing. The fact that the individual looks at himself does not mean that he experiences himself. Therefore, the individual may say, I am a spiritual being. I am eternal. I am immortal. I am part of something greater than myself. But still, because of the position which he takes in actually making these statements, he cannot experience the thing he states. He's blocked by the fact that these are the phenomenal observations of his own unit of intelligence. Consequently, he is not experiencing these things. He is merely affirming them intellectually. He can say, I am part of God, but that does not convey to him the experience of God. Nor does it convey to him the actual proof of the statement that he himself has made. It is an affirmation, not a realization, not an inner experience of being. Beginning, consequently, with the concept of totality and moving downward, we come to the basic problem of what constitutes the essential nature of totality. And here, as I have said, we are merely using words. We do not know whereof we speak. But we have certain internal apperception of some phase, some fringe of what we mean. There is something there, whether we are able to integrate it in our own idea or not. And the thing that we intuitively or inspirationally know or believe with great conviction and intensity is that this totality consists of the absolute unity, not only of things visible, but of principles invisible, of energies, of qualities, of emotions, of thoughts, of ideals, of dreams, of aspirations, of every conceivable and inconceivable function of this mysterious and elusive thing called consciousness. Therefore, essentially, this totality represents more than what we would term cosmic consciousness, more than what we would call the infinite or the absolute in our religious, theological understanding of such terms, more than the term God as we use it in a sectarian way. It represents something which transcends even the concept of being as creature or as a separate and recognizable entity. It is no longer God sitting up somewhere. It is no longer law moving from some radiant center. It is no longer a spiritual sun shining in a celestial firmament. It is beyond all of these things. And we conceive of it as boundless, definitionless, limitless, and all-pervading, all diffusing allness, deficient in nothing conceivable to creatures. This in itself then becomes, to a strange way, or in a strange way, a vast ocean, an incredible space sea. In the Old Testament, in the old Jewish writings, in Genesis, as he said, the waters which were above the firmament were divided from the waters which are beneath the firmament. And the waters above the firmament were called in the old rabbinical law the Shamayim. And this was the infinite, all-permeating sea of light. It was everything. It was the infinite spirit matter, the infinite space-time, the infinite life substance, the infinite consciousness intellect, and yet infinite, boundless, and thereby definitionless, for that which is not with definition of form or kind cannot be defined by thought or word. It is therefore an all-permeating, all-pervading totality of life. So what would be said, what could we say concerning the mood of this? How is it to be experienced? Totally experienced, we probably do not know. Because even the greatest mystic, even the greatest saint and sage in his samadhi or in his trance, the greatest mystic in his apatheistic ecstasy, cannot be said with certainty to have experienced the totality of it. He has come so close to something that he has been overwhelmed by it. But he cannot be said to have permeated to its core or to its infinite completeness. He has touched it and already he is consumed. He has never known, as far as we can conceive, the totality of this thing. Because with the equipment and the power that we have, even the breadth of it is almost more than we can conceive. Yet this totality, this infinite and complete unity of all objectivity and subjectivity, of all content and capacity, this thing which Bhimi calls this and abyss, nothing and all, time and eternity, this tremendousness of reality must also be conceived as this complete all fullness of the thing which we term consciousness. But here again we are using a very definite term wrongly, because it is a diffusion of eternal reality rather than an awareness of something. And this diffusion of eternal self-knowing reality has been represented by an incredible symbolic deity, forever in a state of meditation upon itself, and forever releasing creation internally through an experience of will and yoga. Something whereby which existence comes into being within it by its will, by its own nature. And it remains forever in meditation. And its meditation is creation. And existence is a mood of this eternal existence itself. And theoretically, in the old sacred books, we are told that if the meditating being arouses itself, then creation is dissipated, because it exists only as the dream within the eternity of the eternal dreamer. It is something that is a little too elusive for us, especially in the West. It gets to be too subjective for us to be able to follow it adequately. Now, there's one more quality of this we must mention, however, and that is, to use a phrase used by Gabriel Watts, this being is indeed the all-pervading. It is something which is neither here nor there, but is everywhere, always. It is no further from the individual than himself. It is within him, around him. And so he likes to think when he says, I am here and I am surrounded by these qualities, or I am permeated by them. The sea rises and falls in relation to me, flowing through me. Actually, this is not quite the correct perspective. What really happens is that this is forever there and here. And it is this in which we live and move and have our existence. And it is the reality, and we are in the dream. There is an old Chinese book I found at one time that pointed out that when the gods created man, they gouged holes in space, and that these holes have been walking around ever since. And space is the infinite fullness. And man is a vacuum because he has closed his consciousness to the light of which he is a part. He has shut out the infinite, and therefore is alone in it. But while this might be crude also, there is a philosophic point here for the thoughtful. Thus is actually and factually time and infinity occupy the same place at the same time. Man and the infinite are in eternal identification with each other as far as displacement is concerned. That which separates the finite from the infinite is not distance, but qualitative interval. And this is a kind of a fourth, fifth, or sixth dimension, really, so if you wish to so define it. This interval is actually an interval within man, an interval of isolation created by his own concept of existence. In Eastern thinking, not only by one life, but by many lives, and by the constant impact of phenomena, man falls under an hypnosis, a spell, a glamour. And that spell, or hypnosis, or glamour, relates to the illusion of selfhood. To man, the important thing is himself. To the universe, the important thing is the universe. The universe, the tremendous spiritual universe, is the reality, not man. And the human being gradually unfolding and growing comes ultimately to the realization that the reality in himself is not a unit, but is the presence of a universal reality. That this universal reality, in its own substance, has never been divided. Therefore, that men may be many outwardly, and many mentally, many emotionally, many egoistically, but in their root and substance, they are one. And they are not only one with their own kind, but one with every kind and one with space. That if we can theoretically penetrate deeply enough into the person, we move backward through personality to individuality to universality. Thus that as our objectivity reveals us as many, our subjectivity leads us ultimately, inevitably, to the fact of unity. That this unity is not the ability of the individual to understand his friend alone. This unity is the individual's inevitable participation in the state of allness. Now, this state of allness transcends selfness, oneness as we think of it, because we now come upon a Pythagorean problem which is interesting for us for just a moment, and that is the consideration of the concept of one. Now Pythagoras said there is a one which is the archetype of the first. There is the monad, or complete unity, which is the archetype of the all. So one may be first, or it may be all. One is unity, which is the ultimate recognition of the wholeness of things apparently divided. So one may be the all or the first. And when the one stands by itself, it can also be I, which is selfhood. But this Pythagoras fact we define it, God as one, is not only the first, but the all. So totality is unity. And this unity, Pythagoras called the monad. Because it is one. So that the individual has the experience of oneness, not only as identity, but as unity. Not only the first, but the all. Not only the sum of parts, but the totality, which is a concept superior to the sum of parts. Here then, as we get back again to the East Indian concept of the thing, we have the individual whose actual existence is that he is rooted in totality. He is not part of it. He's not a little piece of it. He's not the northeast corner of it. And as he moves in toward it, he does not move into a totality. He moves into totality itself. He does not become one with something. He becomes the totality of that thing. The individual, therefore, as he approaches totality, must ascend gradually through division. And he must transcend the concept that these units which he has termed himself are parts of a totality. Because the totality itself is not partial. It is as though you took a black curtain and you made many small pinholes in it and put one light behind. On the other side, each light would be a separate light. And the philosopher might say, yes, but they are all rays of one light. That would be good. But there is something beyond that. We can simply leave out the rays part. They are the one light. They are not its extensions. They are not its manifestations. They are not its conditions. They are not little pieces of it. They are it. So the central sense of I-ness in man is simply a little hole punched in the infinite, in this darkness. And what he sees, he calls himself. But actually, it is not a fragment of a greater self. It is not a part of it. It is not an individual spark of the eternal flame. That is a good figure of speech, but you have to understand it, or that will lead to a mistake. It is a very poetic statement, if understood correctly. Because this totality, it doesn't even cast off sparks. It is always all present, everywhere, forever. And the reason why it appears to have separateness is because on the objective plane, the vehicles of its manifestation have what appears to be a separate existence without the realization that they exist because of this complete unity and that their light belongs to it. So gradually we come to the concept that in the totality of things there is one body, creation. And whether it's the ant or the man or the planet or the star, there is one body. And what we call body appears to be a number of forms because we can move in and around the parts of them, but the totality of form is a unit in itself. There is one mind. This mind is broken up, apparently, through the phenomena of human mind-brain association, so that we seem to all have separate minds. There is one emotion. But we all seem to have separate feelings. But these feelings are the conditionings by matter and ignorance of one emotion. We have one consciousness, but because of the differences in the vessels into which consciousness flows, we apparently have different kinds of consciousness. The Zen Buddhists have a way of explaining that is rather nice. They use the concept of a great stream of water to represent this infinite consciousness. So a man takes a round vessel and fills it with this water, and he holds it in his hand and says, "Behold, the water is round." Another man comes with a square vessel, fills it, says, "No, water is square." And another man comes with a long, thin pipe and fills that. And he says, "No, water is a long, thin pipe." In other words, the concept is that this universal reality appears to take the likeness of the forms which hold it. And wherever the diversity of forms appears, we are inclined to assume that these forms define the proportions, dimensions, and attributes of this principle, when actually they do not. The motion of this principle causes it, therefore, to be susceptible of being described as an insect, as a bird, as a blade of grass. But none of these descriptions define that principle itself. And in each kingdom of life, in each way of life, there are symbols which are apparently the manifestors of life. But the life itself is one. The root is one. The inevitable energy is one. And this energy, differentiating on levels of consciousness, intelligence, force, represents first unities of these things within its own sovereignty, being it all. The totality of consciousness is a manifestation of being. The totality of intelligence, or mind, intellect, is a manifestation of being. The totality of force is a manifestation of being. Consciousness, intelligence, and force are a triune aspect of being, at the base of an infinite diversity of trinities and triads and the Trinitarian doctrines of all kinds. But these three themselves, consciousness, intelligence, and force, are again merely appearances, forms, modifications of that which is all of them and is itself also totality, continuum. So in its pure totality, being is the absolute, indivisible completeness, deficient in nothing that is required or possible in an infinite manifestation of its own nature. Man, going into himself, therefore, has to move inevitably as an experience of consciousness backward or inward toward source. This is his only home. The only way home is back into source. If he continues to go out objectively into phenomena, he can go out to the furthest reaches of space, but he will still be imprisoned because he can never escape by extending himself on a level. And on the level of matter, he can go to the end of time, but he will never escape matter. Therefore, he will never find reality. He must recognize that the ladder of faculties and powers which he has within himself must be climbed by himself toward his own source. And that the only way out of ignorance is toward reality. And the only place that reality is accessible to the individual immediately is through the release of his own internals, in his own internal powers. Here is immediate participation in the infinite. Through discipline, therefore, he is taught to overcome one by one the negatives by means of which he is held to a state of Maya or illusion. He is taught to discriminate values, first on very simple levels. He is taught to choose more wisely his interests and activities. He is instructed in penetrating by degrees the illusion of phenomena, which is the illusion of separateness. He is taught that every time that he discovers a common ground, he has made a symbolical approach to truth. That wherever he overcomes a prejudice, he has stated a reality. Wherever he has removed conflict between himself and another person, he has stated a reality. Wherever he has synthesized, diversified knowledge within his own nature, has found common denominators for ideas and opinions variously held. Wherever he has found a link between his own profession and the work of another man, wherever he has found a common ground between the contentions of one creed and the pretensions of another, wherever he has gradually gained the skill to experience unities, where previously he beheld only diversities, to this degree he begins a gradual series of affirmations by action, statements by conduct, moved by conviction, toward realities. Wherever, for any reason, he divides things now united, he is adding to the illusion. So knowledge has as its primary purpose in him, its daily purpose, the overcoming of ignorance. And the overcoming of ignorance is essentially the overcoming of diversity. Diversity, the recognition of the so-called reality of divided parts, is ignorance. Ignorance is based upon the inability to bridge. The ignorant man lacks bridges between himself and life, between himself and others, between himself and the prevailing opinions, knowledge, doctrines, ideas, beliefs of his time. He therefore improves himself in order that he may understand. And understanding is again an experience of unity, often through sympathy. Understanding, knowledge then, has as its internal primary, its great purpose, this demonstration of identities. The proving through experience of sovereign realities larger than parts, and solving any problem of parts by discovering the superior unity which controls them. A man studies an art or science. He cannot proceed long before he realizes that the arts and sciences are part of one thing. He studies science, then he studies philosophy, then he studies religion. But ultimately he learns that these are three names for one essential principle. As knowledge increases, he discovers the identities of these three and their integrity as elements of a unit or of a larger design. So he discovers that above religion, science, and philosophy is the over-concept of truth itself. That they are dimensions or extensions of the idea of truth on a level of illusional or imperfect mind. So his search for knowledge is always rewarded by the experience of unity. Now, on the emotional level, the experience of unity can produce the phenomenon of love. Because love arises from the recognition of values, from an experience toward decentralization of self. There can be no real love unless there is a bridging between self-purpose and service to another creature. Therefore, love is the giving of self to another. It is a departure from self. It is an escape from isolation, which is a term for selfhood. Love, therefore, is the recognition of the good in another. It is the service of that good in another. It is the dedication of personal energy, power, to an impersonal or non-personal objective, the service of another. Therefore, it helps to break down egocentricity. If it is possessive, it tries to draw the object of its affection, and in so doing, instantly ceases to be love. Because love cannot possess. Where there is possession, there is passion, but there cannot be love. So love becomes again a unifying power. We say, love your neighbor, love your enemy. To love must come with understanding. And understanding is breaking down false barriers which have been built between identities, things substantially indivisible, artificially divided by the ignorance in man himself. So everything that tends toward the recognition of unity is an advancement of learning. So we go gradually against the stream. For remember, in the Western world, we have made the great pattern of specialization by breaking up unity. We are paying for that in our psychology of life. We are paying for the glorification of fragments by gradually becoming more and more fragmentary as a civilization and less able to unite, cooperate, or work together for any common objective. We are producing people who think only of their own advantage. That is the end of social unity. And when society ceases to be a wholeness, it dies. For society is a unity and an experiencing unity. And society depends for its survival upon the good of the whole, being elevated above the rights of the individual, yet under a lawful and proper order. Man approaching the mysteries of consciousness must also think in terms of the good of the whole, unity, above the advantage of the divided parts. So he proceeds, and knowledge continues to increase in him as an experience of identities. For this is essential knowledge. It's nice to learn to speak Greek. It's very pleasant to learn to square the circle or trisect the angle. But essential knowledge is the constant pushing toward the recognition of unity. That is essential knowledge. On any and all levels, it causes the individual to ascend to the experience of a totality of some kind. And every totality is a miniature of the universal one. Every totality is a symbol of infinite unity. So that which lives in the approach to totality is living perpetually in a state of worship. Whereas that which lives in a sense of fragmentation is living perpetually in a state of blasphemy, in the discrediting of the divine power, the perverting of its agencies, the misuse of its principles. Knowledge, then, is always moving toward this unity. Not on an intellectual level, but gradually on an experiential level. The individual is learning to become aware of unity. is becoming therefore aware of something which has an existence. And he is also becoming aware of something which, as his awareness increases, he realizes to be greater than himself. Now, the individual does not hesitate, usually, to acknowledge the existence of a power superior to himself. But he lives as though it did not exist. He lives as though any power superior to himself is little better than an interference. Actually, the gradual experience of unity causes man, by degrees, to become aware of the sovereign unity, and to see in each of the united patterns like a magnificent crystal or a snowflake, which is a perfectly orderly unity, the dynamic symbols of infinite unity. That each unit, each thing which is a completeness in itself, is a signal, as Bainey called it, the signatorum realum, the really real positive seal of the infinite. And that reality stamps itself upon all wholeness, and that all wholeness participates in its experience. And that therefore man, to experience as far as he can absolute unity, must achieve this experience through the totality of himself. Now, the totality of himself can imply several things, but essentially it implies the gradual unfoldment of his own potentials, so that there is no longer any deficit or deficiency in his parts by which fragmentation is perpetuated. For where there is something that is strong and something else that is weak, there cannot be unity. So that if man has many faculties, uses half of them and does not use the other half, he cannot have the experience of totality. Totality is the experience of its own nature. And when the individual, through the extension of his knowledge, through the gradual ascent of his consciousness, gradually eliminates the error from the compound, he finally arrives at the summit of his own potential. And then ascending that summit and reaching that summit, which is also the end of knowledge, he finds that the only thing that remains now as an illusion is himself as the observer of all other things. That between him and the infinite, there remains only his own determination to see or examine the infinite and to know it. And that as long as this interval remains, he is not in a state of identity. Therefore, the yoga lead, or yogas lead, to the gradual diminution of this sense of the subject-object. And the individual, having achieved gradually nearer and nearer to unity, discovers on a vast scale that which he experiences first on a simple and human scale. We say in daily living that the happy man is the one who forgets himself. That is also true of the great achievement of yoga. The sublime man, the illumined man, the individual capable of the infinite experience of illumination and identification, is the person who has forgotten himself. And in having forgotten himself, has become susceptible of, or capable of, the infinite experience of being. So as self-forgetfulness turns us from our small sorrows to more useful living, so the supreme act of self-forgetfulness makes available to man the complete re-identification of himself with undivided being. Now, The individual says, I dive into the ocean and I am lost. We do not know that that is so. We know, however, that the individual approaches an undefinable state of absolute transcendency. That he finds all attributes as he knows them, as he knew them, ceases. But with this also comes an incredible sense of infinite security. It comes a complete and total acceptance of totality. And something that we cannot understand until through growth and experience we have come nearer to it. And that is that the individual who gives up himself for reality has given up nothing. He had nothing to give up in the first place, but he had a long time trying to do it. And that therefore, at the end, instead of being a little self absorbed in the sea, he is actually the dreamer who has awakened. The only trouble is, he has no concept of what that waking state is. The only thing that he can conceive of is that he had passed from a state of seeming to a state of being. And because everything that he knows and thinks about has been part of a dream, he is afraid to awake. And because he has no concept of what lies beyond, he considers that waking is annihilation. But there is no evidence that such is the case. For waking is total experience of consciousness. And the individual who joins this consciousness and becomes aware of and immediately diffused in totality lies not at unconsciousness but all consciousness. And in all consciousness, the individual becomes not a God, but God. Therefore, becomes identical with the infinite life, wisdom, love, law. And as this moves all things and is the root of all consciousness, it cannot be said to be oblivion. It is a transcendent state from which man has no available definition. But it can only arise as gradually the illusion dies through the disciplines of knowledge. And through knowledge, man comes finally to know that which is desirable. And in achieving this end, he gathers the resources of his nature for the final decision to awaken. And this final decision brings him into something not knowable by knowledge, but which he could not attain without the experience of knowledge to lead him, guide him, direct him, and in various ways protect him from the illusions and the compounding illusions which come in man's questing. So this, in substance, is all we can do tonight, but the time is up. And we'll have to save the further consideration of this and other problems for a discussion on Rajya Yoga.